And so we're talking about how it got into epistemology. And
yeah. So this is Joseph Klett with Jody Roberts. We're here in the house of Sandra Harding for day two of our oral history. It is April 24th, 2019. And so we're going to pick up, you have decided to go to grad school. You've tried out sociology at Albany, and you decided that a once-a-week meeting in philosophy is a much more desirable commute to New York City than a two-day. Could you tell us more, let's talk here about, you had actually discovered Quine. I don't know if you, did you read Quine in Albany before you went to NYU?
I can't remember, as I remember as we were closing down yesterday, there were 2 years that I can't remember. I was in the seminars that had one with John Gunnell, and then there was with the issue of Kuhn and my philosophy of science teacher at NYU, and somewhere in there, and then Henry Heege and Polish Logic, and we were definitely reading Word and Object there, reading Quine, alongside, I forget his name, some Polish logician, famous guy. I actually knew his name, which is pretty weird. And I can't exactly, so I'm not sure I had read
Quine. When was Quine when was Word and Object published? I don't have a sense
I should know the answer to that, don't you think?
Was he, when was he active?
It's an early 20th century.
He only died recently.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. I gotta have it in here somewhere. How about the science question and feminism? It's from there. OPQ, Two Dogmas in of Empiricism, 1953. Okay, let's try something a little later. It's the only reference I'm making. I mean, I can't remember when this stuff is. It's way back there.
But it is contemporary with Kuhn.
Yeah.
Right. So,
He's younger than Kuhn. He's a little bit younger than Kuhn.
Okay.
But they were both alive, of course, when I was in grad school.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just see if I've got it here. The Web of Belief is 1978, Two Dogmas of Empiricism. I don't have Word and Object in here. There we go, 1960.
Great.
It's Word and Object.
And Kuhn's 62, right?
Kuhn is 62 and then 70.
Right.
Second edition is 70.
So not exactly hot off the press, but you're
close.
People are really investing time in these things at this point. And what I find is interesting is that you were in sociology looking for the alternative, and you found continuity through, at least the way that you've told it with Gunnell, his sociology. You actually find the continuity through Quine,
into philosophy. That's true. I think what we're talking about here is the beginning of the social studies of science, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because these guys were logicians and philosophers, and Kuhn was a historian originally, I think if you had to poll what his greatest people think his greatest contributions, no, I think they'd think it's as a sociologist.
Yeah.
I mean, at least that would be a contestable vision of him. And of course, the two other constraining factors through this period for me. One, I have to stay away from my husband's work.
Right.
I don't
right.
want to get into that work.
Right.
I don't even like it. I mean, at that point, I didn't like it. I never quote them, his people. Partly I'm sick of it, and partly I was sick of it, and partly it just wasn't relevant to what I was doing.
Hmm.
And the other constraining feature, what was the other one that I had in my mind? I'm always working in service to the social justice movements. Feminism originally, and feminism has women of color feminism happening very soon. I was just checking, I don't get onto it in my writing, and my first book is not, there's nothing by people of color in it. And I was checking a couple of the early readers, and the first mentions start to be Patricia Hill Collins and African-American sociologists and historians of science who are So I'm always, you could call it constrained by, but I would call it enlarged by. I'm always reaching over there in my writing to make sure to, in the beginning, to check it out there. I mean, by now I just move into a place. I've moved into Latin America, as I tell Leandro all the time. Though I'm illiterate, I just, my head is, that's where my head is.
Could I ask about the sort of discourse of second and third wave feminism? Was that, did you use that wave terminology?
No, third wave wasn't really, this is definitely second wave. I mean, the second women's movement in the U.S., but also Europe, and began around 19, I mean, they date it to two sources. The resistance to the feminine mystique, right, to the containment in the households in 1950s of women who had been managing all kinds of things while their husbands were away at war. And then they're stuffed back into households after the war. And so that there's that on the one hand. On the other hand, the civil rights movement, because a lot of the early feminists came out of the civil rights movement and out, and consequently out of socialist feminism, too. And so that is at earliest 68, maybe. I think the first women's group formed in maybe New York City in 68. And by 70 or 71, I think I was mentioning already that New York State had a liberalized abortion law in.
And then Albany was sort of a hub.
Yeah, Albany was the state capital, and there were all these colleges all around, and people were, friends were doing their first teaching of women in literature and women's history. And women's history had a much older legacy from the 1920s. I mean, as there was an association, I mean, a formal association. But none of the rest of us had that kind of history, only the historians. And the third wave doesn't get into my, I have paid very little attention to it, I have to say. But it's definitely a decade or more later before it gets going. But meanwhile, the women of color movements coming out of the civil rights movement are saying, hey, white girls, what are you talking about? And writing very challenging articles just take Patricia Hill Collins' work, since she's a standpoint theorist. Do you know her work?
Absolutely, sociology, great.
So she's taking on sociology
and
showing how its categories work are completely misunderstand the lives of black women. She takes those basic, if you take not the introduction to sociology that's normally offered, but the social problems intro in sociology, every one of their problems misses the important role of black women in leadership, in education, different modes of sexuality, different forms of political organizing. She just goes through the weeks of the social problem syllabus and takes them on, but she's also overtly, but kind of sweetly, taking on white feminism that was, we were all critical of the family, and she says, forget it, the family's the last bastion of resistance to the to dominating cultures, and it's no accident that Barbara Smith and a couple of other black feminists named their publishing house Kitchen Table Press. It was around the kitchen table that slave revolts were organized. It was so that was very visible to me immediately, and I had already, with no feminist content at all, been reading, this is the only way I wandered a little bit into Wittgenstein, but immediately pulled myself out. But there were these discussions about rationality. Peter Winch started them and so forth. Was that the 1960s? Maybe, I think it's when I was in grad school, which would put it late 1960s. Anyway, there was an attempt to begin to rethink the standard of rationality in light of Africa. It was studies of Africa and of different kinds of rational thinking in Africa that didn't fit the modern Western image. And so I knew that already, and it was very, you know, it was presented as an epistemological issue.
Right.
It would today be presented because of the ontological turn, you know, the ontological term in anthropology, Viveros, De Castro, and so forth. It would be presented as an ontological issue also, metaphysical.
And so this is at NYU, or are you still at Albany when you're having this? When you said it was immediate to you,
It would have been at Albany because I was... No, it would have been... Well, I was at NYU. I commuted from Albany to NYU.
Right. You had mentioned that the SUNY Albany experience was very quantitative.
In sociology.
In sociology, right.
Yes.
Yet you were also getting previews of Kuhn and Quine, and so, which was not statistics at all.
Well, through Gunnell's political science course, but that was the year before I moved to NYU. Before I went back to grad school.
Right.
So I was in Albany for how long? I moved there in, 66 maybe. I think 64 we were in Poughkeepsie.
Mm-hmm.
And I started having babies. I always refer to this as an era of my life when I was just, I met a guy at a faculty, guy at a party at Vassar, the second year, just before we were about to leave, and I'd known him. And had his kid in my third grade math class that I taught 1 year. And we met at a party when we were about to move to Albany, and he said, "Oh my God, haven't you had that kid yet?"
Because you're still
pregnant for the second time. The kids are only, 13 months apart. So it would have been in graduate school that I was, I can't remember the context in which I was reading Peter Winch and so forth. But on the other hand, it was off on the edges of my husband's work, so there may have been discussions around the dinner table. I mean, I was giving dinner parties for all these, A for A.J. Ayer, right? And I mean, he was having all these famous philosophers into the philosophy department, cooking away and listening to the guy's awful stuff.
Were you able to, in that context, were you able to talk freely? Did you feel like, oh, I'm going to leave him alone, let him do his professionalization?
No, I followed his work very close. I mean, typed his dissertation a few times.
Right, yeah.
And his master's thesis I'd read. So he and I had conversations. I edited. I don't know if I have them. I think I have them. I edited, he edited them, but I actually did a huge bunch of the editing. Well, there's spines looking out at me. His name is on but I did a huge amount of the editing work. I mean, his is the intellectual work. I mean, he's directing it. One was The Problem of Other Minds. One was something like The Other Mind's Reader.
Mm-hmm.
If you look up Harold Morak, you'll find these three little readers that from before I went back to grad school.
Mm-hmm.
So they were in those years when I was grading logic papers and so on. And I loved doing them. It was a lot of fun. I mean, he was in his intellectual project.
Yeah.
But I learned a lot from it by talking over, okay, should I put this one in or that one in?
Right. It strikes me the parallel of when you were in school and the female teacher saying, "I'm not calling on the girls because the boys are smarter." There's the assumption that informally we can understand this. You can edit it beautifully. But there's also the assumption that institutionally there's just places you can't go. You're ineligible to go to those places.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thinking about here when, like, when those informal spaces, or when you recognize sort of in-between spaces, right? That's not the institutional space, and it's not small talk.
Right.
So it is a dinner party conversation, or it's, you know, someone comes in the kitchen to say hi, and maybe you talk intellectual shop.
Yeah.
And especially because you then go into NYU, which you have already, as you mentioned, you know, so many of the young men get shipped off after they get their master's, and so it's a female-heavy PhD program.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to get a feel for this.
Yeah, well, also the wives of some of Hal's colleagues were, so they were married to philosophers too, and they didn't, I mean, I had all this experience doing this kind of technical work, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, in other contexts in New York and so forth, and loved to write and so forth. But I had conversation, Joe Gould, Pat Gould had been his student, I think, at Cambridge or so. I can't remember this story now. This is from whatever, 40 years ago. But she knew a lot of philosophy too. And so there was this little shadow group of wives. I mean, there weren't a lot of us, but there were a few of us. We didn't tend to talk philosophy with each other, but we were comfortable listening and, you know, participating a little bit in these discussions without presuming to be the official philosophers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting, I think, the way you described your relationship to your husband's work at least introduces this idea, even though you're looking for your own intellectual terrain. There is this kind of conversation you're having out loud and maybe internally
mm-hmm.
as well about things could be other.
Mm-hmm.
The system could be otherwise. The
yeah.
you know, our systems of logic, you know, what would it
yes.
mean for us to imagine that?
Yeah.
And that you're interested in maybe starting to wed some of those theoretical concepts with what does that actually mean in these particularly emerging social context as well.
I think that's more advanced than I was at that point.
Yeah.
I think I get to that
yeah.
once I go back to grad school. I start, you know, I have all these kinds of weird experience, both writing, not weird, but, you know, I'm, whatever, how old was I? 33 or something like that when I went back to grad school. Right, so I've been out of college for 10 or 12 years. I was older than that, I forget. 38, I got my dissertation, 5 years, 33, something like that, when I started back in sociology or philosophy. But so we older students, I mean, it's like older students, I mean, now older students are just normal. I mean, there's
mm-hmm.
all kinds of older students coming back, and they bring all kinds of experiences that put them way ahead of the 21-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever, so but this was just happening before that was familiar, before that was common. And it was a little bit shameful. I mean, I wasn't shamed by it, but
mm-hmm.
I can remember the poor woman, the wife of one of my husband's colleagues. He was a miserable guy, and she was a pretty miserable woman. But when I started back to grad school one day, we were having tea or something or other, and she said, Sandra, she said, is your home life so unsatisfactory? Is your marriage and your family so unsatisfying that you have to go back to grad school?
Mm-hmm.
And I just was dumbfounded. I was totally dumbfounded. To her, it was a shameful
mm-hmm.
thing. So this is
mm-hmm.
that world. I mean, you know, there it was.
Yeah.
So I'm curious how you end up writing on Quine.
Yeah,
and how Quine figures in those years as this pivot point
there's something here that happened that I know it happened. I can't exactly remember the details, but here's the part of it I can remember. I had some other topic in mind and wrote up a proposal. So I'm at NYU, I'm at year three or whatever, about to finish classes and start the dissertation. And I took it around to various, what was it? It's a criticism of something or other that was very original. It was probably stupid, I have no idea. I can't remember what it was now. And not one of the professors would take it. It wasn't in their fields, right? This was this crazy returning student, right? And being much more independent than they wanted. And so I shifted to Quine, which was a related topic, and still had the experience that nobody, not one of the seven faculty I approached, would take me for a doctoral student.
Mm.
So I sat down with Steve Kahn, who was the vice chair of the department or something at that point, had a course with him. I liked him. He said, I said, Steve, nobody will take me as a doctoral student. He thought about it for a minute. He said, Sandra, you are a student in this department. You have satisfied all the specifications. You are entitled to a doctoral advisor. And he said, let me work on it. And so I ended up, I'm just going to let that go.
Okay.
So I ended up, Bill Ruddock ended up taking me on. His wife was a very distinguished feminist scholar, Sally Ruddock. She taught at the New School. And Bill was a philosopher of medicine mostly at that time. And he was a really sweet guy. He was around my age, maybe a little, not too much older. And he didn't give much help. I didn't really need much help.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I knew how to do philosophy. I had this Albany
right.
bunch of people, right? And I was dead set on getting through quickly. I was not going to hang around forever, forget it. And so Bill's the one, I mean, after Bill and Rotziel, and there was a third advisor I had, I forget who it was, when I think I mentioned I turned in my dissertation, and when they gave it back to me and said, there's one on page 97, there's one little pencil check in the margin, that was it. No comments.
Mm-hmm.
And that had been my experience with papers. I'd get an A
yeah.
with absolutely no feedback on it,
yeah.
right? Or else I'd get a D. I got a D. I think I had no grade lower than an A, except for this one D, because I'd asked if I could rewrite a paper from I think it was on John Austin or something, I can't remember, but I wanted to move it somewhere else. And he said yes, but then when he got the paper and I gave him the original paper,
mm-hmm.
he had changed his mind. He said, you can't turn this in. So I rewrote another paper. I was used to having a problem getting feedback
mm-hmm.
of any sort, let alone helpful
mm-hmm.
sorts. So
was that the experience of other students, other women students?
Yeah, I don't really know
mm-hmm.
if that was. I can't remember talking. By that time, with my dissertation, I wasn't in that much contact with other students, right? Because I wasn't down at NYU. I actually wrote my dissertation in Edmonton, Alberta. Because my husband was visiting in that philosophy department, and I had told him, I think I told you this yesterday, he had a sabbatical. I said, you want to go visiting? He was thinking Germany, and I don't know where. I said, no way. You can go anywhere you want, but they have to speak English, because we have a 5-year-old and a 6-year-old, and I am not inserting this family into some foreign language community. Forget it. So he picked University of Edmonton, and it was a wonderful year. It was actually terrific. But I was there doing it on my own. I came back probably for the holidays or something. We came back and checked into the department. But
I want to put a bookmark in this, because I think I'm thinking, you know, as someone who's also graded papers, and you kind of set a curve, right? And you
mm-hmm.
imagine. So there's sort of like a. The mystery here is, was this particular treatment that you were receiving because of your identity, or was it treatment because you just happened to excel and they feel like, this is immaculate work, I'm not going to give feedback?
I don't think that was the issue. I think, was it my identity, or was it their normal practice
exactly,
with doctoral
right.
students?
Because
I still have colleagues.
Yeah.
Who are really unhelpful with their students. They just never give them any decent advice.
Yeah.
I mean, I told one of them, don't you dare give this guy who I'd had a bunch of A's on his papers
mm-hmm.
and no comments. They're terrible papers.
Mm-hmm.
And then he comes to me and I have to deal with somebody who's gotten straight A's and doesn't
right.
know how to write. I
yeah.
said,
and you're the bad guy. Because
he's a very good friend of mine.
Yeah.
He said, okay, Sandra.
But it seems like it would have something to do with the field of philosophy where the standard practices is this is not something you can quantify. This is not something that feedback is something that's not necessary. which I think when you, as you develop, you know, your own approach to mentoring, you have to ask, is that
it's not my view,
right? And so that would change the way that you
I don't mentor. I don't know what they were doing. I think they were, I don't think it was that deep in an analysis. I think they just were lazy and hadn't had an experience of being. I mean, I was mentored in other ways. I mean, good conversations in class, right, and good conversations in an office, and so it's not that I had no mentoring, but the when it was connected to grading in any way,
right.
It, or a lot of work on their part, they just didn't do it.
Yeah.
And NYU had a lot of graduate students. I mean, it was a big urban university with a lot of returning students at this point for reasons I mentioned. And, you know, they all wanted to be at, thought they belonged at Princeton and Harvard and were very annoyed at being at NYU, and they weren't going to spend a lot of time on some elderly pipsqueak like me. They were busy, you know, at certain points in their careers that where they were busy with their own work and probably had too much advising to do. I don't know. I really don't know about the history. I think I'm just not as thoughtful as you. You're hoping.
No,
I'm not sure.
What I'm trying to get at is the way that science studies people, particularly, so I'm thinking of like the cohort of people like Lee Starr and Donna and people who mentorship is a very serious, dead serious practice, and that when writing is the currency, not to give feedback is a crime, right? And is irresponsible. And that is something that maybe differentiates science studies from philosophy, or these older practices where it is sort of this elitist thought of, well, if you're there, you're there, and you're there for a reason. We don't need to.
That could be. I don't know that. If I left to my own devices, I would explain it more. I would explain how I got to Quine and my teaching practices and so forth. As intensely connected to my service to social justice movements, I just this morning before you came, there is another. I was having a conversation with Leandro. What was it about now? I know what I did, but what was his question? Oh, it was about. He was downplaying the importance of his work and. I have no toleration for that with him. You have to have a photo of him so you can see these young folks I'm dealing with at the moment. Here's the editorial team. I think there's two of them here, actually. One's the earlier one. Okay, this is the recent one, and this is the earlier one. There's a couple more people in the recent one. So they're all these 38 to 41-year-old, he's the eldest and he's 41, Latin Americans. They're just so fun to work with. And he's worried that his work, he's so busy. He has three empirical research projects, one funded by NSF and the Mexican equivalent, two others, and one on urbanization in Monterey. And I don't know, he's got these empirical research projects, one's with Wes Schrum and one he's, I forget what they are. He's got a full-time teaching. He's got a 9-year-old and a wonderful, brilliant social studies of science wife who's full-time employed. And Tapuia takes a huge amount of time. And so he's worried that he can't do his own work, you know what I mean? And this is the book of his that is so wonderful. And that he was referring to. It's a, I think it's his fourth book, but it's the, it's a version of his dissertation, much later version of his dissertation. And it's very good. And he's always unhappy with it, and I'm always telling him to shut it, cut it out. He said, all I do is manage. He said, Tapuia, he said, I'm not thinking. I said, you're 41 years old, of course you're thinking. And he has an incredible vision. So I outlined for him how my own writing is very managerial. And I never, that's all, it's always in my mind. And it's relevant to what we're talking about here. And it's always in service to social justice projects. They need ways to justify the kinds of claims they're making that look biased on conventional standards, whether it's feminist or anti-racist or anti-colonial or whatever. And so I designed my writing. Here, I was just telling him, here are the ways in which my everyday writing is very managerial. I have to write very clearly, make difficult philosophical and theoretical issues comprehensible to upper-level undergraduates and graduate students. My papers have to be a particular length. 6,000 words is just about right. Why do they have to be that length? Because that's the length that will get republished in anthologies and assigned in classes. If it's longer than that, it won't be. They have to be clear, they have to have, so they have to, my constant attention to good English is about that in part, and short, and they have to be, and I'm always trying to insert social justice movement insights and goals into mainstream SDS or philosophy or sociology or whatever. For example, the subtitle of my last book, the title is Objectivity and Diversity, Another Logic of Scientific Research. And that's an echo of a Popper title. It was The Logic of Scientific Inquiry, but for social scientists, it's research. And so I never forget that when I'm writing. I mean, I do. I'm thinking through a topic or something, but not by the time I get to editing it in any way.
Right.
That's what I'm doing. And it's totally, it's not the image of philosophers channeling truth, beauty, and goodness. And
right.
It's a very practical project, as you could see in that essay, Work in Politics.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to me, given your background in literature, that you would, managerial is not what I would think of, but not the word I would use, but it's pretty apt considering you're coming from literature through philosophy in the era of, you already mentioned, like management studies, right? Like neoliberalization is dawning,
right? I didn't think of that.
To my mind, as a sociologist, like, what you're describing is just good writing. But that's because I've been so conditioned to think the way that we communicate our work is exactly these parameters you've been laying out.
Yeah, but there's good writing that doesn't insert social justice movement concerns into mainstream.
But that's not exactly managerial, is it?
Well, it's connected to the standards of good writing in philosophy, which were analytic philosophy.
Okay.
Right? So I have to figure out how to put these really complex issues into some sense so simple that stupid philosophers can actually grasp it. You forgive me. They say, I don't know what this word means here, Sandra. Give me a break.
I mean, I think what I hear you describing, and I do want to come back to Quine at some point, is you're using managerial, but I think the other, it's just very strategic.
It is.
You have something you want to say.
Yes.
You have a pretty good sense of who you want to say it to.
Yep.
And you know the rules. So it's it's managing rules.
Yeah.
And that's the managerial aspect of it.
I know practices.
So
I know practices.
I know how long this should be. I know what the punch, where the punchline has to be. I know how to frame it up front.
Right.
So that if I do this one effort and craft these 6,000 words, the outcome will be these other six things.
Yep, and I try to get titles that are usually questions, titles of books or articles.
That you answer.
And I try to do, what do you call them, little sound bites. Like strong objectivity. I mean, I really worked over what to call that.
Yeah.
Right. There was the model of the strong program, right? And I thought, let's call mainstream objectivity weak objectivity. That'll get their attention. And the feminist and anti-racist and anti-colonial objectivity is strong objectivity. We're succeeding at your project, mainstream philosophy and sociology. You're not. So that there's a kind of aggressive strategic and managerial doesn't quite grasp the aggressiveness of, of what I very consciously set out to do. So Quine was for me a good choice. What I think I've said this already, but you know, he was trying to get out of positivism, and certainly made some terrific contributions to it, but in the way that Kuhn wasn't a Kuhnian, Quine wasn't a Quinean either, he didn't succeed totally by any means, but he certainly made some powerful moves toward it. And that was as big as I could, that was as big an escape from positivism without going to, for example, continental philosophy or something else forbidden and completely forbidden in my department, right? Mm-hmm. That I didn't read anyway. Yeah. I mean, I read Foucault, but I didn't. Derrida was beyond me and so forth. I don't think he was writing yet then. Maybe he was, I forget. So I was trying to work at the edges of the possible within the disciplinary frameworks. And Quine seemed to, not only that, he was alive. So there wasn't a huge secondary literature, number one. And number two, I'm strategic, right? I mean, people should be fired for allowing their graduate students to write on Plato these days. Oh my God, how could you say anything authoritative about Plato? And nobody thought he had an epistemology, as my advisor pointed out. He was treated as a logician and a metaphysician. Mm-hmm. And so I had to make the case that it was an epistemology. Mm-hmm. And my dissertation is very short. I got it as short as I got away with it, as short as I could. Mm-hmm. I don't know, it's 160 pages or something.
The lack, or the perceived lack of epistemology, is that why the seven faculty didn't take the project initially, because there's no there.
That could be. It was probably a mix. They probably had too many graduate students. I probably didn't want an old lady who had her own ideas about what she should be doing. And besides, I wasn't working on their topics.
Okay.
I mean, that's what my colleagues like. They like students who work on their topics. And I do too. So I tend to take, I've turned down graduate students who just were, they were in musicology or something, and maybe you could bring a standpoint to it, but I don't know anything about musicology. How could I advise such a paper?
Mm.
And so I suggested somebody else to go to. So I think it was probably a mix of practical and theoretical issues.
And what was the role of William Martin?
He was my official advisor for the dissertation.
Not Bill Ruddock?
Oh, excuse me. I always mix up their names, isn't that terrible?
Or Bills.
Yeah, Bill
two
Ruddock.
Men.
Bill
yes.
Ruddock and Rich and...
Martin. William Martin.
Yeah. Wait a minute, let me just pause for a second. Was his name? William, wasn't it Richard? I think I give his name wrong in that article.
Oh, okay. Richard Martin.
Yes, because he once was on an APA program on nomological something or other, and all four participants were R.W. Martin. There were four philosophers.
Wow.
That were named R.W. Martin. I don't know, but, you know, one of them was probably a master's student somewhere, but they got them all on a program or something about. Anyway, he wasn't on my dissertation committee. His own work was way far away from, I mean, he was very much a logician. But he was very warm and lovely, informal advisor. And was always very kind to me. I can remember him, I once gave him a paper for one of his classes, and I'd worked like crazy over it, and I was very unhappy with it. And I handed it in, and I said, I'm so unhappy with this, I'll really be happy to write it over. work on it longer. And he said, Mrs. Morick, I'm never happy with my papers. I thought, oh, I didn't know that, that you could publish papers that you weren't happy with.
Yeah.
I mean, but he, that kind of supportive.
Yeah.
And I was, could be the only person in his class who really liked his teaching style. Most students didn't like it because he didn't prepare a formal lecture. Excuse me. He assigned us readings, and he started the class by saying, okay, so what did you find problematic? Mm. And everybody, they'd all sit there, and they were had their pens ready to produce an outline. And I just love those discussions because students raise all kinds of issues, and he just kept going at it that way. So I enjoyed him on a lot of levels. And he entertained graduate students. His wife was a well-known art historian, I think it was, at Columbia or something like that, and they had a huge mansion, just the two of them, up in the Catskills somewhere, and he had big parties up there for all his graduate students. It was one of these semi-castles up in there, I don't know. She's an art historian, and they bought it with all the art hanging on the walls, probably, you know. So it was a lot of... He was kind of caring for his graduate students in those ways.
Was his admission that he's never pleased with his work, or often displeased? Was that your first time hearing that from a philosopher of that
stage? I think so.
Yeah.
Because he had the courage to publish even though he was unhappy with the work. Mm-hmm. And it gave me a sense that was okay to be. You couldn't get perfect papers always, but it was still worth putting it out there for some kind of discussion. Mm-hmm. And that was not an idea that was... Philosophy had this notion of channeling perfect truth, beauty, and goodness. I mean, I think I only read Kant. I got through my history of philosophy exams with, I was told, the highest grade they'd given on those exams forever. I never took a history of philosophy course except in undergraduate college. The way I studied for all my comprehensives, the department kept a file of questions from former exams, history and philosophy, logic, whatever. And in each case, I took the set of them and outlined answers to what I thought were the, let's say, 10 most likely to be asked, which ones appeared on 4 of the last 6 years, right? Strategic. Design those. And then you had, these were usually in-class exams, I think, for 3 hours or something like that. And sure enough, there was exactly the question on Kant I'd prepared. I mean, I read only the little parts. I have no idea what Kant says about anything. Uh-huh. But all the things that had appeared on the exam. And so I had a very selective approach to becoming a philosopher. I mean, I must have read more Kant because he appears in Introductions to Philosophy. I taught those for years. So let me see, what were you asking me? You were asking me...
We were just talking about the role of Richard Martin. Was he the chair at the time?
No.
Was one of your early...
He was just a very senior member of the department. And he'd been there a long time. I forget where he was before. And he wrote logic books and ontology books, and people thought he was kind of fuddy-duddy. I thought he was wonderful.
When you're delving in Aquinas at this time, and... I'm wondering about what science is, like as you're doing Quine and you're thinking about, say, the philosophy of science. Like, how are you imagining what science is? Is it a practice? Is it
Am I thinking about science? I don't think I'm exactly thinking about science. Hmm. I'm thinking about whatever counts as the best knowledge, but not thinking particularly about science. Kuhn, I'd be thinking about science. But not Quine. Quine was coming out of logic and metaphysics. And I don't remember, I haven't read it in decades, but I don't remember any particularly close analyses. There must have been some, but I don't recall.
So you're following, I mean, so I think it's an interesting distinction. I mean, so you're not after a specific, as opposed to maybe others who might interview in and around kind of origins of STS, where there's a science quandary at the beginning that they have to go explore. You're really coming at this from a very solid philosophical set
yes.
of questions about logic
yes.
and epistemology.
That's right.
And that you end up over
and
in
how
science.
To produce the knowledge, how to
right.
justify the kind of knowledge that the social justice movements
yeah.
How to justify that.
So do you think, so I mean, I don't want to ask it as like a conjecture, but I don't know how else to say it. But I mean, in some ways you end up over there because is this the only area where there are active debates about epistemology?
I end up in STS?
Yeah. So I mean, do you end up looking at science in part because the other epistemological models seem so set that
mm-hmm.
the only place where there seems to be some discussion about whether or not the model is right
mm-hmm.
happens to be Quine and Kuhn
that's,
in
that,
these,
that could
in
be
these
a good way
spaces
to put
where
the issue.
They were accidentally opening up a space.
I mean, I was looking at science in some ways because I was looking at standard accounts of women's biology, of treating, you know, the discovering reality is full of Ruth Hubbard and, you know, it's full of scientists and non-scientists writing about the problems of science for women because they don't understand our bodies, they don't understand our histories, they don't understand this, that, and the other thing. So it's not that I was avoiding science or
yeah.
not preoccupied with it. I mean, at times I would be, but only as a student of what the critics were saying about it. And I wasn't independently exploring biology texts or doctor's offices or doing any of those sociological things. So it was, you're right, I was coming into it from a philosophical background that took its cues from the social justice movements. The other thing is that it might be that you and I are using the word science in different ways. I'm thinking not here so much as something that came up yesterday. I can't imagine. I can't remember. Oh, science versus technology. Because I refuse to use it. I tried to use the term high science in here in my last book, and they didn't let me use it. High science versus science. So science for me includes technology and indigenous knowledge, and I apologize for that, using it, it to include indigenous knowledge and everyday local knowledge in my last book, because nobody uses the word science for that. Modern Western science doesn't, and indigenous people don't. But I wanted a level playing field, is what I say in the introduction, I think. And so I now use it exchangeably with reliable knowledge, whatever count is. It counts as reliable knowledge. And so it's interesting. I was just rereading that other biographical piece that I found.
Mm-hmm.
I was re-looking at it this morning, and why is this issue? Oh no, I was looking at a couple pages of one of these criticisms, Science Wars criticisms, and Alan Sokol and Bricamont, you know, Sokol and Bricamont, that book, they're taking out after me. And they're trying to be very kind. Of course, many of the things she says are true, but the conclusions she draws are ridiculous. I mean, that's just, I had three pages of it. And they never consider the point I'm making. It's not that modern physics is wrong, but that there are other questions that never get asked because of the industrial military funding of science, and science is expensive to do. I mean, there's whole literature now on neglected diseases and so forth that are prevalent and easy to cure, but the pharmaceutical companies aren't going to make any money off it. So they don't get funded, and Chagas and some of those ones in non-Western, non-industrial societies. And so for me, the term science is a very slippery one, and I'm always very trying to figure out how people are using it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't buy into the argument that, a conventional argument that science explains how things work and technology applies science to the world. I don't buy that at all. I think technology, technological practices produce their own kinds of knowledge that fit or don't fit with the dominant scientific theories, and that has to be worked out.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just plenty of cases. I mean, so that that's one reason the dominant science philosophy can dismiss non-Western knowledge. It's all, they might have technical proficiency, they say. They know how to build the Great Wall of China and so forth, sail across the Pacific Ocean, but they're not scientists.
So I'm going to put a pushpin in the reference to the military-industrial nature of the production of science, because I think Joe and I were having a discussion about the 50s at breakfast, since that was lot of our conversation yesterday, and what sticks out. But I want to tie that, because I think that might come back to the question that we also tabled for now, which is what feels so threatening about these alternative approaches. And I think we might be slowly uncovering what we think might be a place for that. But I want to get us maybe back on the timeline and think about where we were yesterday, so we filled in a little bit more of the detail, but this transition to the University of Delaware, and you know what that meant for you personally, professionally, intellectually.
I was very happy to get a job, number one. I got several offers, Lehigh, and I forget what the others were. But I needed a place where I could move my kids, and I didn't want them too far away from their father, so I wanted to stay roughly in the Northeast. And the department, the philosophy department, was very attractive to me for two reasons, well, for several reasons. I mean, they had had a master's program in philosophy until, I think, the year before. Maybe it was still existing the year I got there. And it had a specific focus on philosophy of science and on chemistry. Surprise, surprise. But it turned, that's why it failed, because it turns out chemists aren't theoretical and philosophical, so nobody was going to take a philosophy degree and focus on chemistry. But they had found a couple of philosophers who did focus on chemistry and had them in the department. So there was that, but the department also had high involvement in precisely the kind of program I had come from. What did they call it? So I come from this early admissions general, maybe it was an honors program, is that what they called it? But it was interdisciplinary, and it was working with very bright undergraduate students. And there were a lot of faculty who, the head of the department was in the philosophy department. The next head of the department came from the philosophy department. So they had this interesting multidisciplinary possibility. They were going to be as pissed as most philosophers were when I was hanging out with sociologists, right, and historians. Chair of the department was a great defender of me all the way through. He had a couple of serious sexually scandalous guys in the department. There was one other woman in the department. She was Italian, aristocratic, and had been married to a Palmer. Is there a very famous historian named Palmer? Lucia Palmer? Or did he have a different name? I forget. She had been divorced, she had divorced him, whatever, by this very famous historian. She was so elite and so elegant. And she taught Plato and Aristotle, and students wanted to learn Greek when they took courses with her. She had them all in there learning Greek. I mean, she was the only other woman in a 15-person department. The chair, Frank Dilley, he died just a few months ago, and I was thinking about him. He changed, he very much wanted me in the department. He made sure he got the rules of the department and the rules of the college cleaned up so that I could get through. I mean, he respected what I did a lot, and I was publishing, plenty. My actual tenure vote in the department, was 100% yes. But when you read the tenure letter, you would never know that. The tenure letter picked out all the things they didn't like about what I did. But it was 100% vote for me. So he managed to maneuver. Okay, you can say what you want about her, but you got to vote right. Look at this record. He did that kind of thing. And one of the guys in the department who came to no good end was a young guy. He was the philosopher of science in the department. And he tried to publish a collection of papers called Medusa or something, Medusa's Philosophy. It was an anti-feminist critique, right? He was going to put a picture of Medusa with the snakes on her head on the cover. I mean, I found out about this not from him, but because Ian Hacking, who was at Princeton at that time, I think, sent me a letter, a copy of a letter. I didn't know him, though he'd been on my tenure committee. I'm not supposed to know that, but I'm pretty sure that he had written a tenure letter for me. And I didn't really know him well, and he was writing a lot of tenure letters for women philosophers. But he was pretty good at marrying women, too. I mean, he had his own history, but that's that. And he sent me, without any notice to anybody, a copy of the letter he'd written to Chris. And Chris had asked Ian for a paper for this collection. And it was this. Ian Hacking was at Princeton at the time, and Chris was a Princeton graduate, so I think maybe Chris had been a student of his, I can't remember.
And just quickly, this is Chris who?
Bors. And Ian said he was ashamed to discover that one of his students was involved in such an anti-intellectual and nefarious project. I mean, I can't remember the wording, but I read that and I thought, oh my God. You know, and there were a couple guys out there who were doing that stuff. Richard Rorty was regularly. I mean, I distantly knew him, but he was writing letters for tenure for women philosophers in this era. So I got tenure in, excuse me, when did I move there?
1976.
Thank you. Yeah. 76. Okay, so 79. I'm not sure. Sounds right. Is that right? Sounds right. So Rorty and Ian Hacking, I mean, they were big deals already, and there are probably a couple more. I can't remember exactly who, but it was an interesting era. You know, I was in the Society for Women in Philosophy. There had already been established the Committee on the Status of Women in the APA. I mean, so we were active in the APA, they knew who we were publishing, and we knew each other. I mean, we had these networks that were extremely important. We were mentoring each other and everything. But there were some of these guys who just stepped up to the plate.
Just to rewind the tape a bit, because you were also, your first job was at the Allen Center.
Yes.
In Albany. And that's, you had actually, is it right that you got the job before you passed the dissertation?
Let me see. Is that right?
Chronologically.
I was there 3 years, and I moved from there in 76. I think I got the... No, I got my dissertation in 73, right? I'm sorry to ask
you.
No,
you're right.
73, and I took the job halftime. I had other possibilities, but I had two small kids, and I didn't want to commute an hour each way over to somewhere that had a job I could have taken. There was a halftime opening at the Allen Center, which was brand new. I think it maybe that was its first year. I was there for its first year of existence. I think it only existed for 3 years. I'm not sure. It was shut down the year I left, I know. Maybe it had been open the year before, but I'm not sure.
I ask because it feels the way that you narrated in the Work in Politics piece is that this is where the sort of tires hit the ground, so to speak, that this is where you encounter Christine Pierce,
mm-hmm.
People who are actively working, as you say, we had to invent feminist philosophy at this point.
Yes.
And it sounds like that you brought that sort of cottage industry with you to Delaware.
Yes, but I met there immediately wonderful feminists. Gloria Hull was her name at that point. She has an African name now, and she's been at Santa Cruz forever. But she was... All the men are white, all the blacks, like all the women are white, but some of us are brave. She was involved in that early African American feminist collection, and had she was in literature, and had done a lot of work writing on black women, and was herself African American. So she was one of my best friends. And Maggie Anderson, who is a sociologist who edited two or three big readers over 30 years. I mean, they named the rooms of their house for some of these readers. her specialty was race theory, and she'd grown up in Atlanta. And so there was a current director of women's studies whom we all hated. And then Maggie and then Gloria and I directed women's studies there for, I don't know, 15 years between the three of us. And so they already had, I mean, I brought a very distinctive experience. It was Albany women's studies wasn't quite as well developed yet as Delaware was. Moreover, the race issues were really significantly different. Race issues were so central in Delaware, right? It's a border state, the Mason-Dixon line, and this university being the state being party to the busing decision from the Supreme Court, and a couple of those early men and women, African Americans who'd been active in those civil rights struggles in Delaware, were around the university and around the women's studies community. And so the feminism was deeply connected with the race issues in Delaware in ways that they weren't. There was a, Albany was a, the Young Lords, there was a powerful civil rights movement in Albany too, but it didn't get into the Allen Center or into the, I didn't at any rate get into it. I don't think I knew any black faculty at SUNY Albany in those days. and there were only a few at Delaware, but I knew them immediately. And started organizing with black women and had an appointment in African American studies at Delaware. And taught a course on African and African American philosophy in, I think I would say, 80 and 81 or 81 and 82. And I was trying to get the philosophy department to hire somebody who actually knew stuff about it. I mean, I taught Frederick Douglass, and there was a book on African, one book on African philosophy or something. we did hire somebody, and I, Bill Lawson, and then I didn't teach it anymore, but I was very involved with the black community. Black intellectual community in Delaware. And Delaware is a tiny state, you know, so the politics are real up close in the university.
Yeah. Was there any kind of shock or surprise when you went from the Allen Center to Delaware where race all of a sudden, you know, we talked earlier about the sort of the dawning of the third wave and the influence of black scholars.
Third wave isn't anywhere. I don't know what you're thinking about. Is third wave feminism?
I guess I mean the dawning that women of color have a different perspective.
Yeah, but that's not the third wave. That's part of the second wave. Third wave comes a decade later, and it's a really younger generation. Third wave as I've heard it used, is more about the 90s, maybe, and back in the 80s. I mean, so the end of the 70s is the beginning of, I mean, the end of the 60s, 69 or so, is the date of the beginning of the second wave. So it's about 20 years in there where we're in the second wave. And so that women of color feminism is part of that second. You're right, it's a very specific thing that happens. And it's different from how it started out with Betty Friedan and the Second Sex, right? But it's not yet what I've heard called.
Okay.
But I could be. I'm so out of touch. You're probably more in touch.
Well, no, I think you're describing the more of a historical activity, and I'm thinking more of the ideas that are starting to gather, and folks like yourself are the first to take them up, particularly when you encounter this new.
Yeah, but I was trying to look and see where I first started raising race issues. And I think there's actually, does Discovery Reality have a couple of essays in it already? Excuse me, I can't remember what I saw here. No, I think Discovery Reality doesn't. That's interesting. Okay, because this is. This is the 19th, what is it, what's the this is the second edition, 2003, so 20 years earlier. This is 83. And so, but by the time I get to feminism and methodology, which date is, what did I say, 83? Okay, so 87, or 4 years later, and I have several, I have Joyce Ladner, The Introduction to Tomorrow's Tomorrow, The Black Woman. I have I think I have another race paper in here. Where is it? Is that the only one? No, Bonnie Thornton-Dill, The Dialectics of Black Womanhood. So that Black women's movement was already very active by then, the early parts of it, and I was starting to pick it up. But it wasn't reshaping my thought. I treated it, I think, kind of as an add-on in a certain way. Of course, it changed. It meant you had to think about whose lives were being talked about. But it certainly was, it's not that it didn't affect the epistemology. It just, in retrospect, I think it extended the epistemology to new groups. Start from women's lives, start from Black women's lives, and start from Asian women's lives, and there was a Jewish women's feminist movement emerging. And so it certainly changed what white women were saying, but it was only beginning to form a real network, and it wasn't yet doing what's happened in the last 20 years. I mean, this whole pluriverse, it didn't get into the ontology. Actually, it did in certain ways, but Viveros de Castro always talks about, you know, indigenes in the Andes Mountains. I mean, he's not looking at women's movements. So I opened one of my recent essays with, it's one of the Latin American ones, with the argument that actually the arguments of science and technology studies were already made by the feminists and the new social movements of the 60s. And there's slight gestures toward that in the early STS, non-feminist STS, but they're very slight. I mean, they're using the same kind of language. I mean, Kuhn opened the door in scientific revolutions, right? I mean, revolution, right? I mean, he was connecting it to a different historical revolution, of course.
Right.
But so there were things in the air at that time that were floating around and only partially grabbed by different groups, and they don't really gel in significant ways. But I was interested to see where I'd started talking about these issues. But I'm not into post-colonial work yet.
Yeah, so can we dive into what you just mentioned? I mean, I think there's two different paths we could follow. One would be, you know, what did you think Kuhn opened up accidentally?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think I'd say accidentally just because I think there's so much post-Kuhn interpretation of Kuhn's work, as you suggested earlier. And the other is, when do you think you became conscious of the fact that the science studies folks were just re-asking the questions that the feminist theorists had already been trying to sort out?
Okay, could you hold that for a minute?
Yeah.
And I'm going to get some more water. Oh,
yeah, let me take a question.
I'm sorry.
So I said, oh, that's okay.
Just the last thing, and I'll remember.
We could go two different directions.
Yeah.
One would be, what do you think is the space that Kuhn opened up?
Oh, okay.
And the other was, at what point do you realize that the science studies folks are just asking, re-asking questions that the feminist theorists had already been grappling with?
Well, I think Kuhn opened up the space that Jasanoff characterized as sciences and their societies co-construct and co-produce each other. And I think he opened that up in the way that he looked at the history of science.
Mm-hmm.
And Feyerabend, I was just looking at Feyerabend recently for a variety of reasons. And of course, he opened that up even more. And when I taught at the Allen Center, I forget if I mentioned this, three of my colleagues were guys. Two were physicists and one was a mathematician. And they'd all come from Berkeley. And Paul had a serious crisis. Should he continue being a guitarist or should he get a job in physics? He came to the Allen Center. He was a lot of fun. But he had been in Feyerabend's class and had a purple mimeograph copy of Against Method.
Hmm.
And he knew Dorothy Smith's work, which I didn't know. And so those three guys sat in at the Allen Center on my first philosophy of science classes, and then they took me out to lunch and they said, Sandra, you're not going to pollute these young minds with that positivist stuff, are you? That I just learned. I mean, I'd just gotten my doctorate.
Yeah.
they were a pleasure and a pain in the neck. But it was very interesting. So I don't think I have a lot more to say about it than, for me, Kuhn opened, it was a really different kind of history of science than I had encountered, and it opened up the sociological, deep sociological questions in kinds of ways that I didn't know anybody else who was opening them up, except that guy whose name I still can't remember. Science, and it's when I can find it if I checked. I know I put it in a bibliography.
Where was Dorothy Smith at the time? Was she at BC?
No, she could have been at BC. Or was she already at Toronto? I can't remember. She was either at OEC or at BC.
But that was your introduction to
Yes, it was that early paper of hers. She had given it at the American Sociological Association, I think, in 1972.
Hmm.
But the next papers to it, she had a couple papers out in the late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But then around 79, I was a peer reviewer for Signs on Hillary Rose's first paper. And I complained that this paper was not citing the work of Hillary and Stephen Rose.
Mm.
And it needed to, but of course, she could have been blinded.
Right.
I met her shortly thereafter, and Nancy Hartsock and I had been meeting for a few years. She was at Baltimore, and Donna had been at Baltimore, and they had taught a course that refused to die, and so they were meeting with a couple of graduate students 2 years later still, and I joined that, and year one Donna was in it, and then Donna went to Santa Cruz. So the next and then Nancy and I started writing papers to each other, standpoint papers to each other, in effect. So at any rate, there were a whole bunch of people who were doing that, but let's go back to
Kuhn's
sociology.
Rabbits.
Yes, Jerome Rabbits. Science and its Social Problems. Isn't that the name of it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little earlier than Coombe. It's a couple of years earlier. Okay. I didn't discover it till after Coombe, but then when I read it, I realized he was really grabbing some of the issues.
Yeah.
But the other direction you asked was, how did I...
Well, what point did you... Do you think you started to realize that this
science studies
was asking those questions? And it might be another way of thinking about how your intellectual work evolved at Delaware to put you then in contact with what was emerging as science studies.
You know, I'm not. I wish I could remember when I first went to an STS meeting. I think they date for 4S meeting. They date 4S to what, 76?
Roughly, yeah.
It wouldn't have been that early. That would have been just a couple of that. I would have just been moving to Delaware. I wasn't in it yet. And I can't remember anybody at Delaware who was in ST, who was in 4S. But I don't think it was as late as when I moved to UCLA. So somewhere in there, I must have gotten hip to STS. But my recollection is that at the beginning, I think probably co-organizing feminist work with Ruth Hubbard, and who was maybe attending. Who else was attending? Donna was in 4S early, so maybe it was through her that I got there, I can't remember. But I remember it was very hard to get audiences for feminist sessions. There were plenty of people who wanted to talk about women in science, right, and policy about women, but there weren't people into the epistemological issues. And I've gotten quite close to Wanda Bauspies now. You know who she is. And she was organizing those sessions, and she was way back, a little closer to that side than she is now. I mean, she's now much more deeply into exactly what I'm into, but in her own ways. And I can remember going to a session of hers, and she had five panelists, and I think there were three other people there. And that's what would happen at our sessions, too. Occasionally, some guys would lurk along the back of the walls. They didn't want to actually sit down, but they wanted to see who was up there.
Yeah.
The same thing had happened at the APA earlier with philosophy. So I think that 4S was a little slow to come to those issues, and maybe that's also because in Europe, intellectual feminism, if I can put it that way, was slower. They were ahead of us on quotas for women in parliament and, you know, some of those practical things. But Hillary Rose was doing standpoint theory, and of course the Marxian tradition was much more powerful in Europe than here. I mean, not that it was consciously being practiced, but it was part of their intellectual history in a way that was not the case here. And so I can't remember when I first started going to 4S or what I first started doing, but I got aware of that kind of resistance to what I was doing. Not that it was overt that I can remember. So let me see, the science wars. I have to look at that because I want to see what the overlap is. When did the science wars start? I outlined this for my own purposes. Here we go. No, this isn't it. Excuse me, I've got too many papers here. I'll find it sitting right here somewhere. I figured out it had a 20-year. Here we go. So it really gets going in the 1980s. I think I told you the Centesa board threatened to resign. That's 1983. And Yalko gave us Discovering Reality in the Centesa book series. And then in 1983, yes, it was after Discovering Reality came out, I think I mentioned this too. The guy who was head of our division at NSF, I can't think of his name, had a summer NSF grant and was getting ready to apply, and I was chatting with him about what it should look like for a term off, a term long NSF grant. And he called me and said he was really sorry. I mean, he did it on the telephone. He didn't want to write it. Mm. But he couldn't give me any grants because he was being so inspected by right-wing politicos that it would damage NSF if NSF gave me a grant. Can you imagine? Mm-hmm. And then, so that's 83. Then it really gets going in 94, because that's when Higher Superstition appears. Levitt and Gross, you know Higher Superstition? Which has a whole chapter on me and a whole chapter on Donna. And there's a terrific analysis in one of these books in Ross 96 by Roger Hart, whom I think I mentioned, of the chapter on me. I think it's in After the Science Wars, is that right? Is that where Roger Hart is? That's where Steve Fuller's terrific bibliography is. No, it's not in there. It must be in the Science Wars. So the Science Wars are very connected to me with this issue about STS.
In what way?
Because I took the Science Wars to be about STS.
And so you suddenly found yourself lumped in with a group that you didn't see yourself with originally?
No, that wasn't the issue. The issue was that in attacking me, they were attacking STS. It's not that I didn't identify with STS. I can't remember, as I say, I just can't remember when I was first going there.
Well, I was thinking, too, that you had referenced earlier that you drew on the language of the Strong Program as you were formulating Strong Objectivity. So is that one pathway in for, what was your...
Yes, Bloor and Barnes, and I was reading...
And so when did that happen?
That's a good question. I'd have to check the bibliographies. Pretty soon after they published it. When was that, in the 80s? Mm-hmm. So probably in the 80s, so probably about a decade. So I was reading Bloor and Barnes. I knew Karen Norsatina because her husband was in the chemistry department at the University of Delaware, and they were commuting between Bielefeld and Delaware. And I had lunch with her a couple times in Delaware, whenever that was. But she wasn't really into feminism, and she was a little leery around me. But I knew her work. The Manufacture of Knowledge, is that the title of it? So whatever that date is, I was already into that work. And I was into Bloor and Barnes shortly after they were produced. And met. And also into two Americans who'd gone to London in the 1960s to escape the draft. Why are their names? Les Levitow, who I'm back in touch with now. Do you know him?
I know the name,
yeah. He's an ex-editor of Science as Culture. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I called him up and had a good discussion with him when we were putting Quia together. We called up editors of other journals. And it was really fun to talk with him again because I'd met him in London decades before. And Robert Anderson or something like that, I've got his reader in the other room. But Les Levitow and this other guy, Robert Young, you know Robert Young? Were by now firmly Brits, but they'd both been Americans who, to escape the draft in the 60s, gone to England. And they were both working kind of on the borders of where I was working. I mean, I found their work very simple. They were very critical of the dominant standards. They weren't into feminism in particular or into... Robert Young was into the race issues because race was a big intellectual issue in England in that era. So I don't remember being at 4S then, but I do remember meeting these guys, and they knew my work, I knew their work, and so I was making connections with these people.
And Young, if I recall, worked on philosophy of biology. Is that right?
Yeah, I think he did originally, yeah.
So it's interesting to think about kind of theoretical boundary objects of sorts, you know, so you coming in from race, but coming from a race and social justice perspective, encountering science studies, but because there were folks like Young and others looking at science that suddenly got them to those social concepts, and whether or not there were these kind of emerging topics where these groups could meet. And whether or not that's one potential place where these different theoretical frames maybe began to be in conversation.
Yeah, because they were both very philosophical. Their kinds of criticisms of mainstream science were deeply philosophical. And I was also, I think it's around that time, but I'd have to look it up in some bibliographies I've got here, that I started reading the Critiques of Modernity. There were a couple of modernity collections that came out by historians that were talking about the violence that was done by assuming modern Western modernity was the only form and how it had participated in capitalism. And okay, so also I was working on the development issues already. I was probably starting to teach a course on women, gender, and development. I taught that course for a long time. I loved it. And I met a lot of the people from India and everywhere who were publishing in those realms. Yeah, so I have to mention, just tag this other issue too. I was traveling a lot. I spent 3 weeks in South Africa, sponsored by HSRC, the Social Science Division, 3 months after Mandela became president. Would that be 93? And I was at where was I based? In Pretoria, I think. But I was 2 weeks in Pretoria. Yes, that's where HSRC was. And then I was around the country, Cape Town and Durban and Port Elizabeth. Who's that South African guy? He was in Port Elizabeth. Was such a terrific theorist. I can't think of his name, but I was there, and sometime. Okay, so just before 95 was the year of the woman, I think, in the UN, and so in 94 and 93, there's about a 3 year period here where I was doing a lot of UN work. And I co-edited this chapter of that. So this would have been 94, Design for the Year of the Woman. We wrote that in 2 months, and it's, I don't know how many thousands of words. I mean, I'd met Elizabeth. So PAHO, the Pan American Health Organization, had hired me to teach a course in Costa Rica and on epistemology, and then give lectures sponsored by the health ministries in the next four countries north. So, what is it? Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, maybe. Three countries to the north. So I was meeting all these Latin Americans and South Africans, and their philosophic issues were not the philosophy of science that I was used to. I mean, so I had, their issues were about the problems with modernity and the Enlightenment and the way development was imposed on them, and how could they needed health services that were not provided by the federal government, and they had all these strategies for designating peasant men from the mountains as health chief for that village, but it was feminist work that they were training them into, because women were the health providers in the communities, but they had to make the guy the chief from the federal. I mean, it was fascinating. So it was a mix of feminist and anti-racist and anti-colonial and development and anti-modernity issues that I was just exposed to, and they had no place in any philosophy of science department. They just had no place in it. So I was working in this other world that was happening and exciting, and they loved my work. I mean, in the a set of sessions that UNESCO and UNIFEM organized preparatory, I think it was a year before that. So UNIFEM had had complaints about science and technology since the League of Nations in the 20s. They would produce lists of bad health policies for women. But they had no epistemology. So when they saw standpoint epistemology, they grabbed it. So I was so popular. It was both rewarding and unnerving because I hadn't thought it in their context. And I just was walking around with my ears open all the time and smiling a lot, hoping all went well. I was giving lectures to an entirely non-English speaking audience, and I came back sounding like Castro because I always had a translator standing next to me. And so I'd speak, da 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 da. Pause. The translator would do that phrase. Da 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 da. And I came back talking like that, and my friend said, Sandra, what happened to you? But it was immensely exciting. And so that is all going on at the same time that the questions we were talking about my relationship to STS are happening. And STS was more open to it than philosophy of science, even though it wasn't doing it yet. I mean, they weren't doing their international projects. And I never went to the, I never even, well, maybe, I did go to a couple in Europe, so maybe they were. I went to one in Bielefeld. I think I can't remember when that was, but maybe they were co-sponsored by the European SDS community. But I don't remember any of the post-colonial work in those early SDS meetings.
And I just want to be clear for the recording's sake that the document you were referencing is the Gender Dimension of Science and Technology, which was done as part of the World Science Report.
That's right.
That's what you gave us the
book. And yes, and it's an extract from the 96 World Science Report,
right.
And it, not the whole report, and you know what the World Science Reports are. They sit on coffee tables all over the world, right? Engineering firms' coffee tables to show they're aligned with international good policies. This particular chapter, they ran special discussion presentation sessions on in Jakarta, as UNESCO did. Jakarta and somewhere in Latin America, they invited me to come, but I was too busy to go. And they'd get all the local journalists there because this was the first time feminist issues had been presented in this epistemological way that gave them a handle on it. And they published this in... thousands of copies in seven languages and distributed them at You're the Woman that was meeting sometime around then, or whatever it was.
Since we're on this topic, you had mentioned previously that you, speaking of your managerial writing style,
yeah,
that producing this kind of report, not only in a very short turnaround, but knowing you have a very different audience.
Exactly.
Can you say a little bit more about how you went about approaching that strategically?
Okay, so Elizabeth McGregor is a Canadian animal doctor, veterinarian.
Mm-hmm.
And I met her somehow through some UN thing, I forget what, and loved her. She galed these stories of how all the veterinarians delivered each other's babies. I mean, she, you know, large animal, the farm veterinarians, they knew how to deliver calves, they could deliver babies, and they all delivered each other. You know, she, these wonderful tales. She was at the time the assistant to the head of Canadian Development, whatever that was. And she was organizing women around the feminists around the world under the veterinarians around the world. She in Cairo organized a women's conference. I mean, it was veterinarians she was organizing. She could get away with. But then they were doing feminist science and technology. So So I asked, when I got invited to do this, they had asked a number of other people who were fully qualified to do it, and they were sociologists. They'd all turned them down, and I knew why. It was much too big a project, and we needed data, and who could do it? And of course, by the time they got to me, it was December, and this thing was due the end of January. It was just before Thanksgiving. So that's not when they got to me. That's when I said yes. They came back a second and third time and said, "We can't get anybody. Could you do it?" And I realized this was an opportunity I should grab. It's going to be hell on wheels, but it's to have this opportunity to get it in print. And I mean, the big thing about the UN is their distribution, and you know, they have all of these distribution strategies. So I decided if Elizabeth would help me, I'd do it. So I asked her, and so we did it together. So I'll just tell you one thing as a start. So, let me see, how did this happen now? Yes, okay, so the first thing we did is commission a historical essay by Lambda. Panina Aberon, do you know her at all? So it was a history of science, and we put it first in here. Panina had written a lot of histories of science. And I turned this into the draft of it, into the boss I was working for here, I can't remember who it was. And he immediately shot back at me, "Sandra, that's an essay." He was accusing me. Mm-hmm. We were going to put it first in the volume. And so then I had some discussions and with Elizabeth, and realized we had to write with little bullets in front of the paragraphs. We had to pull off these little topics, and you're not supposed to write with little bullets in philosophy. Mm-hmm. You had to say these things very simply. He said, "Nobody has time to read an essay. Nobody's going to look up that bibliography." He said, "You have to write in a kind of way that can reach this audience." And it was a completely different phenomenon for me. So that gives you one eye. So we had to put that great essay in the back of the book. Mm.
So the essay wasn't too casual. It was too long-winded. The problem, when he says that exclamation, this is an essay.
It didn't look like this.
Yeah.
It didn't have data points.
Didn't have data points. It was quite accusatory. It was an essay. That was just the beginning of a whole bunch of working with, both the realizing that, you know, I met all those health ministers in Nicaragua and Honduras, these guys who were great on the dance floor. Right. I mean, they were a different kind of health minister than I was used to. They would be invited to dinner and they'd be dancing afterwards, and the Honduran minister of health, swivel hips, was dancing around. It was a lot of fun. But it was constantly trying to figure out how to work in these contexts that were not ones I was used to, but were really important to work in. Mm-hmm. They wanted what I was doing if I could figure out how to deliver it to them in a form they could use. And so I just kept at it.
Do you have any, did you get any feedback on the report?
They loved
it.
Jakarta, they had hundreds of journalists there from all over Southeast Asia, because it was the first time that anybody imagined that science and technology had a gender dimension.
Right.
And what we did is this is between a report and an essay and an anthology. We commissioned a few little short pieces, that one historical piece by Panina, and I became friends for quite a few years with the head of the statistical division at UNESCO. Because Elizabeth knew her, and so I was stealing her, and we sent her the essay. I said, "We need data." She loved it. She was an Iranian Parisian. And for years afterwards, she would call me up about her niece's problems with her boyfriend and all of these feminist issues. She had these discussions, feminist discussions, and she loved us. She kept saying, just let me know if there's something else you need. And she was so happy to be contributing to this. So all of that, my task was to make sure I could read the same way it is now when we're publishing data. I usually don't understand exactly what's happening, but I have to be able to read these. And the captions frequently don't permit me to understand what's going on. So I insist, you have to speak to stupid me if you want to present this material. I'm doing it with Tapuia all the time now. It's fascinating. I've learned how to do it. So in those years, there were all of these different things going on that were STS projects in some ways, but they were not within 4S's. I was kind of circling around 4S, I guess, is the way I would put it in these other contexts.
Before 4S, before STS has these institutional gathering places, something that seems like a constant, at least through your time at Delaware, is the role of reading groups.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, you know, feminist reading groups, like most activistic reading groups, they're very informal. They come from people not getting what they need elsewhere. And so I was wondering if you could talk about maybe lessons that you took from early reading groups, but particularly how you use them, because it sounds like even up until this, 96, you're still not finding institutional interdisciplinary spaces that are allowing you to have the conversation.
Yes. Two reading groups that were indeed, one was directly on science and technology studies, and they were both at Hopkins. And one was Liz Fee. Elizabeth Fee is a historian of, is she at Hopkins? No, she was at one of the federal, she was at NSF or somewhere, she was somewhere in Washington, one of those big agencies, I forget which one. But she was in public policy at Hopkins, I think also, I forget exactly, University of Maryland, whatever. So she and I and her graduate students met for, I don't know, we would meet every 3 weeks for maybe a couple years until that fell apart. But that came after that reading group I got into that was the course, The Wouldn't Die, that Donna Haraway and Nancy Hartsock had taught. And of course, Donna was into science and technology studies. We didn't always address science and technology so much as epistemology. I don't know what to say what I took from one to another. I mean, a reading group's a reading group, and you figure out how to use it and make it work. But they have always been very important to me.
I guess I'm thinking in terms of the reading groups that happen amongst, say, hell, we're all political sociologists, for example, and there's this new thing here, let's bring it in, and Thomas Piketty writes his book, let's all read it and see what does this mean for our field. As opposed to, these institutional walls are preventing us from seeing these matters as, you know, the social justice dimension, for example, that a reading group, an institutional reading group or one that happens in the purview of a department doesn't allow us to be as flexible or nimble in the applications of what we're doing. Or I'm just wondering, because definitely when Donna talks about she may be referring to the same reading group, the role of fiction and writing fiction and, you know, dealing with poets and artists and people that are
she
part
did that,
of that
more than I did
network. Yeah.
Well, I wasn't trying to reform philosophy. I've more recently been trying to reform philosophy of science without having to suffer being anywhere near them. You know, but I'm clearly they're my target and the Philosophy of Science Association has radically changed in the last few years, but they were so awful to me. I haven't been back for 20 years, but I think Allison Wiley has been a president, and Helen Longino. I mean, they've been taking leading feminists as their marker. So Nancy was trying to reform political science. Mm. Patricia Hill Collins was trying to reform sociology. But I wasn't trying to reform a particular discipline. I would be happy if I could have, but it never, I wasn't going to work with them, and I wasn't teaching them, so to speak. I was in these other departments. I mean, I had a joint appointment at Delaware. I had a joint appointment the whole time to the sociology department and taught a course on methodology, not methods, but methodology and philosophy of science that was required of all the sociology graduate students. And so it was a joint course between philosophy and sociology. So I had had more sociology graduate students in my courses than anybody else in the sociology department, which is why they finally, I was writing all these reference letters, and so they finally, you know, said, Sandra, we gotta give you an appointment in this department. So my tasks didn't get defined in exactly that way, but of course I was focused on changing, on providing philosophies of science that were useful for the groups I was interested in. I mean, Sharon, I think I mentioned this, Sharon Trawick arrived at UCLA the same time I did, and we went to each other's projects, and I knew her ahead of time from when she was at MIT, and she said to me, after a year of following me around, she said, Sandra, I figured out what you do. You plant yourself on the edge of an institution and you refuse to go away. And that is true. That's what I was doing. But I think for Dorothy Smith and for the sociologists and political theorists, political scientists, they were much more embedded. They were in those departments, and I wasn't. Oh, I had a philosophy department appointment at Delaware, was my main appointment, but that's the last time I've had an appointment in a philosophy department. I never did at UCLA. Mm-hmm. They didn't want me and I didn't want them, but they were very kindly to me, and I taught the feminist philosophy course for 20 years and got, when I was leaving UCLA, got sweet letters from the guys in the department and so forth. I mean, they were very happy to have me teach, but they're so backwards. I mean, they're so into the epistemology and metaphysics curriculum of the Cold War. They have almost no branches out of that.
This might be a good time to ask this, because you had also worked in politics, mentioned, you mentioned, it was some book that you were referring to. And you're saying that the effects of the Cold War on American philosophy were pretty crippling, whereas literary studies was influenced by it but worked its way out. Mm-hmm. Could you expand on what you meant by that?
So let's take philosophy of science. So the Vienna Circle, okay? They were almost entirely Jews. They were all socialists. They began moving to the U.S. In the late 1930s. Reichenbach, I think, came to UCLA around 37 or 38. I had dinner with his wife when I first arrived at UCLA. She was much, much younger. He died sometime before. And he hired Carnap. Carnap visited, and my office at UCLA was the one that had been Carnap's. So the compromise that the Vienna Circle made when it confronted, I tell this in the beginning, story in the beginning of my last book, as a way of talking about how the philosophy of science we have is the one that was fundamentally formed in this particular circumstance. Most of the Vienna Circle ended up in the US and a good number of them at UCLA at some point. They went to Paris or somewhere first, and some of them didn't come to the U.S., but most of them did, where they encountered McCarthyism. which was not, they were all socialists. McCarthyism was not happy with them. And McCarthyism was anti-Semitic. It was deeply anti-Semitic, and these were all Jews. And so the way, the best book here is Reisch's book, R-E-I-S-C-H, that came out a decade, Robert Reisch, is it Richard Reisch? Do you know the book? How the Cold War Transformed Philosophy to the Icy Slopes of Logic?
No. Is that the, do you know, is that the one you were referring to? In that?
Yes, it is the one I was referring to. I think it's Robert Reisch. Let's get it. George Reisch. How the Cold War Transformed Science to the Icy Slopes of Logic, Cambridge. You want to see it? It's a terrific history. I mean, Nancy Cartwright had been doing some work on the other member, not Reichenbach, what's his name? Another member of the Vienna Circle for some time. But this is a comprehensive study of the effects of the Cold War on philosophy of science. So let me see. What was the question?
So this actually comes after, because Work in Politics is 2002.
Yeah.
And this is 2005.
Yes.
I think the book you're referring to in that statement is actually from the early 90s, and maybe it's about literary studies? Maybe that's a distinction.
I can't remember what it is. I'm so sorry.
No, I want to read this stuff myself. So we're talking about the sort of Cold War effects. Like, how did you see the Cold War effects of philosophy?
Oh, okay. So the Vienna Circle had to make a hard choice. And what they decided to do is go with Carnap rather than Reichenbach and the other guy whose name I can't remember, who Nancy Cartwright writes on. I'll look it up because I think I cited her in here. Did I? Excuse me for just a second. All right. You going to interview her?
I don't think she could come up, but I've got quite a list going just from our conversation when we last see this.
Neurath, Otto Neurath, Philosophy Between Science and Politics, 2009. But she'd been writing a number of papers earlier. But I don't know who I don't remember. So the choice they made was to take out the politics from their Vienna Circle logical positivism. And it, this was the same time that ordinary language philosophy, it's a little before John Austin, Wittgenstein, and then John Austin, ordinary language philosophy comes in. And the two fit together perfectly because neither of them is interested in history. Right? They're both interested in the larger political environments within which science occurs. And so Reisch talks about, that's what he means by to the icy slopes of logic, that the philosophy of science becomes fundamentally logic. And it loses. And the Vienna Circle agenda, the unity of science thesis that Neurath, I think, was Neurath the author of that?
I think so.
Yeah. Was intended, it was a call to the sciences in the early 1930s when Nazism was forming to address the social issues that were about to be solved in horrific ways, and they could see how that was happening. It was a clear political call. By the time I heard about the unity of science thesis, it was a reductionist theory about how physics is the basic science and everything else is reduced to physics. I mean, it was a completely different meaning to it. And so Reisch is just so good about capturing this deeply socially responsible political agenda that the Vienna Circle had, how they all had to escape the Nazism and what happened to their philosophy when they got to the U.S. So they cut it back to save it, in effect. Cut it back to Carnap's program, because they could see that philosophy of science, and indeed science, would be endangered in the U.S. if the full political program that they had called for in Europe were maintained in the U.S. So it's a very sophisticated argument about politics and philosophy. And so my beloved philosophy of science teacher had been a student of Carnap's, right? And we had, we celebrated Carnap's birthday in his class each day. And I thought, wow, I mean, each year I'm in some kind of special club here.
You know, what you're saying about, you know, the the value placed on studying real people, living people, that this is sort of an access, right? Like the sort of genealogies of intellectuals who work together, and that you were kind of connected to Carnap through.
Yes,
his students.
And that's long before Nancy Cartwright started writing about Neurath, or, you know, Reich's book came out.
Another pin. I mean, I wonder if this is something to come back to in terms of seeding what becomes science war places of debate, because there are again these, the way you just discussed this. I mean, there are large stakes.
Yes.
In this debate.
This is
not a philosophical debate.
No.
This is a deeply political debate.
That's right.
That has ramifications for all of the fields involved. And how much, again, you know, these kind of choices that are made to be able to persist, what arguments had to become to look durable.
Yes.
But whether or not they also contained within them some tensions that
really
could not be resolved.
I mean, I think for me it was an incredibly fruitful experience to have.
Yeah.
To get to live through this moment when the Cold War philosophy was prevalent, and then the shift was happening, but people didn't quite know how to do it. And because at the same, you know, this is all happening. It's such an, if you pick any single year to talk about, it's a very complex scene of different groups, half wandering around and half intent on something that may or may not be useful, or maybe was or wasn't successful.
Yeah.
It can't be presented as a wonderful singular line history of some sort.
But I think you're also putting these boundaries of of time on something that is sometimes, like other controversies or other wars, debated as something that has been in existence for a long period of time, and saying, well, no, this is actually part of a very recent phenomenon.
Oh, I see.
And dated to, you know, these particular decisions.
Oh, I see.
And so I'm finding that very helpful, kind of bookended by, on the more recent side, that in 1994 we have Higher Superstition, but in 1996 you published your report for the World Report on Science to great fanfare.
Yes.
And so
it's all going on at the same time.
This is a very limited amount of time where there both seems to be
great
anxiety and debate, and also
great thrills about the work
that
I'm
doing.
This
is actually right on, and that and so
it wasn't confusing to me at the time. I understood there are people who like your work and there are people who hate your work, and you know who you should be working with, right?
Yeah.
But I always had to think about who was reading it and how it would be used.
Right.
And so, as I was explaining to Leandro this morning, my work has just always been very strategic and managerial, because I'm always aware that all of these different people are reading it and doing different things with it. And, you know, people ask me, so how come you aren't arguing with somebody or other who came out with some criticism or different reading of what I'm doing? And I say, you know, it's like your children. They go out and they do whatever they're going to do. And you can try to pull them back, and I do every once in a while with my work, but fundamentally people are going to do what they're going to do with it. And my efforts have to be focused on how to make the work useful in the kinds of ways I care about. And kind of, I mean, I've had enough job stability. I've never had a problem. I was never threatened with being fired. I mean, I had Medusa around me, and you know, some jerks around me sometimes, but I've never worried that my job would be in danger. Though that tenure moment was a little bit too exciting when I said, great, I've got it, and then I read the letter. I said, wait a minute, is this the letter supporting my tenure? Gloria Hall had the same thing. She, it had happened to her the next year, I think. I said, Gloria, just take it and run. And so we were always living in the middle of these cross currents of, yeah, it's funny to think how involved academic, you know, the Delaware dean I loved, because when I was directing women's studies there, she had a monthly meeting of all the department chairs. And so there'd be, you know, 30 in the College of Arts and Sciences. So there'd be 30 people in the room, and 28 of them were guys, right? And she was the wife of Alvin Guldner. And she frequently pointed out to us when we were getting into big arguments that university departments are very distinctive. They have the shortest career ladder of any professional field you look at. There's like 3 steps and that's it. And there's nothing to do but make trouble after that 3rd step. She said, so you have to find something else to do. I mean, of course, a lot of them were finding other things to do. They were growing roses and not doing any physics. Right. They were whatever. But she had a really good institutional view of the peculiarities that show up in university work and the intensity of people's arguments. I mean, it's like that we're more identified with our thoughts and writing than in other fields. I mean, doctors are identified with what they do. You do it or you don't.
It's interesting the way you point that out, because like, as soon as I learned what tenure was, when I was maybe in high school, my understanding was always, your goal is to get tenure so you can make trouble. It insulates you. That's the whole point. And so, like, it's interesting the sort of the maneuvering through those 3 steps that we do to appear, you know, sort of to hew a certain line, to stay within the edges of the institution, and to veer close to the edge, maybe for our own integrity, but to not fall off the edge, because if you fall off the edge, you'll never get to make trouble.
Yeah.
You'll just kind of be irrelevant.
But I've had to choose where I locate myself very carefully. I mean, I located myself in a graduate school of education. When I first got a joint appointment to sociology, my philosophy colleagues said, commiseration, Sandra. They thought sociology was a terrible field for a philosopher to, they would never think of wanting one. It gave me a whole freedom. When I came to UCLA, there was a debate about what department my line should be, and I didn't know about this until later. It was a big battle that evidently occurred over me. So I was being hired, women's studies had gotten a half line from their dean, and they were looking for another department to put me in. And so they'd get a half line from some other department. That's the way women's studies hired in those days. And they very much wanted me, and there were 2 battles over me before I got there with that I didn't know about. There was 2 women in physics who were very critical of feminist work. They both were active feminists in terms of supporting women in physics. But the kind of stuff that Sharon was doing and I was doing was quite another matter. And they were both involved in women's studies. They raised a stink. And there was, I forget exactly how this goes, but what I know is there was 1 famous meeting, evidently, of the women's studies program and the dean and provost. And the dean and provost were told to get the women's studies told them, appoint her, right? And they had some conversations ahead of time with these guys. And so by the time, meanwhile, I didn't want to go into philosophy. History wasn't really appropriate, and history wouldn't want me there. I mean, I couldn't teach the basic history courses. But the Graduate School of Education, so it's a graduate school, right, that we're not training teachers, had been recruiting me. because they had a philosophy of education line open for 4 years, because they could never get a candidate that satisfied both the philosophy department and the education school. So they finally pulled the line out of philosophy, had it solely in education. And I'm not a philosopher of education, so that wouldn't have been a good fit for me. But what happened was they hired Doug Kellner. Do you know him at all?
I know my name.
Okay. He's politically great. I mean, he writes on all these, he's very left and writes all this media stuff.
Right.
They hired him for the philosophy, the main philosophy of it. It's an endowed chair he holds. But there was a second position attached to it, so they hired me on it. But what they hired me to teach is exactly what I want to teach. I never have taught philosophy of education. I don't know anything about education. And so I, you know, they wanted me to teach standpoint theory, the methodology courses, and feminist theory. So, first of all, I had to consider whether I wanted tenure. I was tenured at Delaware, of course, and I was a full professor. But if I was commuting for 5 years between Delaware and UCLA, and poor me, I couldn't be on any major committee on either campus because I was only there half the year. It gave me all this extra writing time. And I thought, if I get tenured, I'm going to have to go on those big university killer committees, which I hate. I've managed to escape all the big worst ones. I'm a good citizen in departments, but not. I mean, because I've had so many 20 years of administrative positions, so I have enough meetings without, you know, it's been my argument. Anyway, so I went into this very unusual school for me, for a philosopher to go into, to do. They have not replaced me in that school in terms of what I teach. I mean, they should be ashamed of themselves, but I think there aren't too many Sandra Hardings around who are really willing to locate in a school of education.
Mm-hmm.
It's too low a status school for the arts and science people. But I didn't care at all, because I had my own status and was quite independent of whatever department I was in. And if I could teach what I wanted to teach, they all wanted me, and students loved me, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had to think carefully. Yeah, I did consider not getting tenure, because they have a visiting line that can be 10 years long, renewable. Not auxiliary, not lecturer. It's the next one. Not assistant. It's this other kind of line at UCLA, and there are people who teach on it for decades, and they're never tenured, but they're full professors with all the privilege of full professors. And I thought, that sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
But then at the last minute, I thought, I don't know. I don't really know how that's going to work for me. Maybe I shouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
The people I know who do it don't do controversial work, and so it's easier to get rid of that line because
right.
it's not tenured. I thought, I shouldn't be stupid.
Mm-hmm.
But I was moved. How old was I? 60 when I was 60 when I was moving to UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I moved. I figured I better move from Delaware now, because I'm already almost too old to be hired at the what it's going to cost them for a full professor
mm-hmm.
if I'm going to retire in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been offered a position at Stony Brook in the philosophy department. Stony Brook was very attractive for a lot of reasons, but. I decided the University of California was UCLA was a much better choice for me, so I did it. But, so I've had these kinds of career considerations
mm-hmm.
a lot.
I think we're in a good place, because we're both